Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here with
Genevieve Kosky
and
Keith Phipps.
Tasha Robinson is on the mothership tonight, recording the epic Top Films of 2017 podcast with a film spotting crew, but she'll be back next time. Here on the Next Picture Show, we believe that no film exists in a vacuum and that all culture is more interesting in context. So every other week, we get together to talk over a classic film and consider how it relates to a current movie. This week, we're riding our two speeds over cobblestone, eating apricots and gelato, and tanning our pale undercoats on the Mediterranean with two films about forbidden passion in Italian summer. It's December in Chicago, Genevieve, so this sounds like a much-needed vacation for us.
I wouldn't pack your bags just yet, Scott, because it's not all fun in the sun. While this week's films might make the Italian tourist board happy, their characters are wrapped up in secret desires, heartbreak, and even murder. Anthony Minghella's 1999 thriller, The Talented Mr. Ripley, transforms Patricia Highsmith's novel into a story of sublimated gay desire as an American con artist travels to Italy to lure a shipping heir back to the States, but falls in love with him instead. The new coming-of-age drama, Call Me By Your Name, is also about an American visitor overseas, but this time he's the object of lust for a 17-year-old who's trying to come to terms with his sexuality. In both films, all that surface beauty masks a private pain.
I'm going to cling to the surface beauty part, Genevieve, because it's really cold and gray right now. On the first half of this week's episode, we'll look at The Talented Mr. Ripley and discuss how Minghella turns the cold calculation of a chameleonic charlatan into the covetous cravings of the consummate changeling. Then later in the week, we'll stop with the tortured alliteration and consider the bittersweet love story at the heart of Call Me By Your Name and what it reveals about the sensitive teenager who's swept up by it. But after the break, we'll address the age-old question, jazz, the great American art form, or insolent noise?
Dickie Greenlee? It's Tom. Tom Ripley.
Tom Ripley?
We were at Princeton together.
Did we know each other? Sorry, what is it?
Ripley.
How do you do?
We'll just be for a little while.
No, I like him.
Marge, you like everybody.
Marge, you like everybody.
You stay at Dickie's house, eat Dickie's food, wear his clothes,
and his father picks up the tab.
What did you actually do in New York?
Telling lies, forging signatures, impersonating practically anybody.
What?
I wish I could live Dickie's life for him. I know what I would do.
Did I know you at Princeton, Tom? I don't think I did I?
I always thought it'd be better to be a fake somebody than a real nobody.
Why is it that when men play, they always play at killing each other?
I feel like I've been handed a new life.
I wouldn't have cared what anyone thought.
Everybody should have one talent. What's yours?
Back in 1997, when Matt Damon first broke through as a star with Good Will Hunting, the New Yorker film critic Anthony Lane dismissed him as someone who couldn't pass for Cary Grant's bellboy, much less leading man material. The line was intended as one of Lane's signature quips, but it's inadvertently a great insight into Damon's particular strengths as an actor. He doesn't carry himself with the confidence of a handsome movie star like Cary Grant, or even his buddy Ben Affleck. He specializes in characters who are ambitious but half-formed and restless, always looking to become someone that they're not. He's the janitor turned savant mathematician in Good Will Hunting. He's the doughy middle manager who wants to be a secret agent in The Informant. He's the blank slate who's searching for himself in the Bourne Identity movies. Tom Ripley was the role Matt Damon was born to play. In Anthony Minghella's bold conception of the Patricia Highsmith character, Ripley is a tragic figure who longs for happiness and intimacy and connection, but feels he needs to negate himself to get where he needs to go. As he says, quote, "I always thought it would be better to be a fake somebody than a real nobody." And Minghella emphasizes that his Mr. Ripley is talented, certainly more so than Dickie Greenleaf, the shipping heir played by Jude Law, whose only talents, according to his father, is for spending his allowance. As Ripley cheekily confesses to Dickie and his girlfriend Marge, played by Gwyneth Paltrow, he's good at telling lies, forging signatures, and imitating almost anybody, but the talent of Mr. Ripley doesn't just leave it at that. We can appreciate the hard work and imagination Ripley puts into inserting himself into Dickie's life, not to bring him home, as he's been asked, but to attach himself like a barnacle to Dickie's wealth and freewheeling lifestyle. And later, once Dickie's dead, we can appreciate Ripley's ingenuity in running a con that allows him to claim that life for himself. And on the merits, he deserves it. Ripley can hustle his way into doing anything, while Dickie is a poser who can't even blow a decent saxophone. Highsmith's novel was adapted before by René Clément in 1960's Purple Noon, which starred Alain Delon as Ripley, but there's a soul to Minghella's interpretation that departs from the 1960 film, and from the book, too. Ripley does indeed become fixated on Greenleaf in all three versions, and Greenleaf does eventually grow cruel and abusive toward him when he feels stifled by the relationship. But Damon's Ripley wants desperately to be known and accepted for who he is. Gay, for one, but also somebody whose transgressions have now gone beyond the capacity of anyone to understand and forgive. The tragedy of the talent of Mr. Ripley is that his sins are a barrier to the intimacy that he longs to have. Minghella opens and closes the film with a shot of Ripley in profile, all alone after having to strangle the man he loves. And the silhouette of Damon in the dark room is so haunting because it resembles an empty canvas, somebody who has the talent to assume another identity, but is himself faceless. That makes him dangerous. We know that because we watched him murder three people. But he's also tossed us the key to that dark room in the basement, and we can feel the loneliness of the man locked inside.
I don't believe that letter, do you? Dickie's letter. Do you believe it?
I don't know what to believe.
Can you imagine, though, if you did kill Freddy, what that must be like? Just to wake up every morning, I mean, how can you? Just wake up and be a person. Drink your coffee.
I mean, whatever you do, however terrible, however hurtful, it all makes sense, doesn't it? In your head. You never meet anybody who thinks they're a bad person.
Oh, no, but you're still tormented. I mean, you must be. You've killed someone.
Don't you just take the past and put it in a room in the basement and lock the door and never go in there? That's what I do.
God, yes. Of course, in my case, it's probably a whole building.
And then you meet someone special, and all you want to do is toss them the key. Say, open up, step inside. But you can't, because it's dark, and there are demons. And if anybody saw how ugly it is,
that's the music talking. It's harder to be bleak if you're playing Knees Up, Mother Brown.
Okay, so this movie came out in 1999, which was my first year as a professional film critic. And so 1999 was a very special year for me in that respect, and also in that it was a particularly great year for movies. So I have a real fondness for Talent Mr. Ripley, which was one of my favorite films of a very special year. But I want to ask you all about your history with this film and how it holds up for you.
Well, the year was 1999, and I was just able to hire a young film critic named Scott Tobias as a full-time employee. I know, it was a great year, and this was part of it. And it came out pretty late in the year, too, right? There's sort of like an also this quality to it, if I'm not mistaken.
It was like the Phantom Thread of that year.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. Boy, was I happy to revisit it. I liked it then. I'd forgotten perhaps how much I liked it. And I'm sure we'll get into this later, but seeing this cast at this period in their careers after knowing what's to come is certainly interesting as well.
Yeah.
Scott, do you really want me to tell you how old I was when this movie came out?
Oh, my gosh.
Why do you always frame this that way?
I shouldn't.
I have to do
well,
this.
I was...
I was a freshman in high school.
Okay.
But this is my second time seeing this movie. I don't think I saw it when it came out. It was probably a couple years after that, possibly even in college.
You were not old enough to get into it.
Yes, that was what was stopping me, I'm sure. No, I definitely had watched this before and had distinct memories of it being a film that I never wanted to watch again. And rewatching it this time, I was struck by what a well-crafted, well-wrought this movie is that I absolutely hated watching, because it is so anxiety-inducing for me. And that's a compliment in the context of this movie. Like, I'm not saying this is a bad movie, but it's a good movie that I really don't enjoy watching just because of sort of the empathetic response I have to it, and because it is so adept at making you feel the tension that is building in this web that Ripley is weaving. And like, you know, it's going to snap. And when it does, and then snaps again, and then snaps again, it's really hard for me to watch.
I'm curious to ask, like, when do you feel those feelings? But do you feel them toward, you know?
They start when Philip Seymour Hoffman's character pops
up. Okay, so you're concerned more with things getting exposed and then the result of that rather than this deception.
It's the con, it's the deception, but it's also kind of the interpersonal relationships that are happening between Dickie and Tom and between Freddie and Tom and Dickie and Marge in the situation, and just sort of the unspoken resentment that is building and building and Tom still continuing to press against it.
Yeah.
It just kind of from a like social mores perspective, it really sets me on edge.
Not to psychoanalyze you, but probably just in general, watching these movies, some of the tension comes from the fact that we are so much Tom's partners in crime in this. Mm-hmm. We're so much from his perspective. We know his vulnerabilities. He's a dangerous, probably a sociopathic person, but you can't help feel from him a little because the performance is so rich and because we're just there by his shoulders the entire time. And I think to want a bad person to not come to a bad end is such a wonderful thing that movies can do just mm-hmm. by being what the empathy machines, to use the Roger Ebert term.
Right. Yeah.
It's not a comfortable watch. You're right.
Yeah. And I think like the reason it sticks out as such an uncomfortable watch in my mind is because it's initially presented as something so lovely and appealing and it draws you in. And that is entirely the point. And I fall for it. You know, I fell for it both times, clearly. And then when the divide happens, it's just like, oh, you got me.
Yeah. Well, it's not kind of that sick feeling of inevitability that, mm-hmm. that things are going to start to unravel. You know, when Freddie does show up, it's like he sees right away
yep.
that Tom Ripley doesn't belong in that world, and he has no reservation about pulling on that string or poking at him or doing whatever is necessary to reject Ripley from a world in which he does not belong. So I get that. I guess my thing, though, I've seen it many times, maybe because I actually kind of enjoy being in that kind of a situation.
Because you're a little bit of a sociopath.
I'm a little bit of a sociopath. And also, I just think the filmmaking is so seductive. I mean, I just mm-hmm. that feeling that, you know, summer in Italy thing, and we'll get into that certainly with Call Me By Your Name. It's just so appealing on just a technical level, just like the location work, the photography, the score and the music, you know, the beauty of all the actors, you mm-hmm. know, it's just like, these are really gorgeous people. And I think every single major actor in this is at the absolute peak of their game. I mean, this is Jude Law's best performance, right? I mean, in addition to Damon, I mean, has Jude Law ever been this good?
I like him in AI. But yes, he's amazing in this.
Yeah,
he's
great. And Gwyneth Paltrow is perfectly cast, mm-hmm. and you know, and Philip Seymour Hoffman is just so unnerving.
The physicality of that performance, just from like the second he enters the frame, just yeah. the way, like the swagger, but like there's like something just off about it. It's yeah,
he's so officious in his the way he holds his hand, mm-hmm. his little hand gestures and stuff. I mean, you could say it is it's mannered. I guess you could maybe criticize that performance as being mannered.
Why would you do that? I wouldn't.
Yeah. But
the only thing that throws me is Kate Blanchett, who's great in this. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong. And I think she was probably like 29 when she made this. But to me, she is like permanently 35, 38. Like
yeah.
Even now, registers as that age to me. And when she was younger, she registered as that age to me, too.
Yeah, I had that same brief reaction watching this time of like, Kate Blanchett, this character is too immature for her. mm-hmm. You know, she just has that innate kind of old Hollywood glamour that I think you kind of associate with more worldly characters than Meredith Logue is.
Yeah, she can play the blue blood convincingly.
It's true.
For sure. But what's interesting, and maybe Keith, maybe you can speak to this a little bit more, because you've read the book, have you not?
It's been a while, but yeah.
And you, I think you're familiar with Ripley just broadly, right?
Right. I've read a couple of the Ripley
books. So what could you say about Minghella's particular take on this character and how it does and doesn't deviate from the novel?
It is truer to the plot than Purple Noon, which is a great movie as well. Highsmith never shows you this much Ripley. There's never sort of that interiority. He's never this sympathetic. He's definitely more of a cold-blooded sociopath, even in this first book, and more so in the subsequent book I read, and I believe even more so as the series goes on. Boy, I really need to finish that series at some point. And you're not going to get as deep of a, you're not going to plunge into his psyche as deep as this film does.
How pronounced is the sublimated gay desire in the book?
Again, it's been a while, and the book was written in the 50s, but it definitely is expressed as a possibility. I believe Marge accuses him, outright accuses Ripley.
Marge is much more hostile, at least during it, you know, than she is in this film. I mean, obviously, you get to a point in this film where she turns on him and doesn't believe him and thinks he's done something terrible, but she's perfectly happy with him being around. And
yeah, the changes the film makes, I wouldn't say they're correcting flaws in the novel so much as taking it toward the vision that Minghella wants it to be, which is definitely more of a character study than Highsmith attempts, which is what a good adaptation does. It takes, uses what it can and makes it into a movie.
I mean, I think people forget, or maybe they don't forget, but Minghella was a playwright and a terrific writer of his own right. He did his first feature was a film called Truly Madly Deeply, which is excellent. And I think it is, it's such a thoughtful adaptation to hold true, as you say, to the plotting of the Highsmith, but change the emphasis, change the perspective, give you a kind of a take on Ripley that's a little bit different. And I can't get around, you know, I mean, given what we see him do, it's amazing how much the film holds your sympathy for him right to the end. For me, I mean, maybe that's me as a sociopath.
Even at the end, he's an awful, murderous, tragic figure. I mean, you know, he is going to dwell in the dark for the rest of his life, and he may be very good at it. I mean, there's no sequels to this film version of Ripley, but I can imagine this Ripley going on and doing some of the things that he does in the subsequent Ripley novels. But I think this is the moment of him losing his soul.
Yeah. But he starts from a place that so many of us can recognize of just wanting a life that is better for ourselves and aspiring to, you know, be in love and to have things you don't have and to
be more charismatic than you are.
Yeah. I mean, which is everything is so easy for Dickie Greenleaf. He's so charismatic and he's got all of this money. But if you talk about talent, you know, in the title, I mean, all the talent is on Ripley's end of this equation. I mean, the way he's able to do so many different things and he has so many facets.
Everybody should have one talent. What's yours?
Forging signatures, telling lies, impersonating practically anybody.
That's three. Nobody should have more than one talent. Okay. Do an impression.
Now? The only talent my son has is for cashing his allowance.
What?
Oh, I like to sail. Believe me, I love to sail. Instead, I make boats.
Stop!
Other people sail them.
It's too much. You're making all the hairs on my neck stand up.
Oh, yes, jazz. Oh, jazz, let's face it, it's just insolent noise.
I feel like he's here. Horrible, like the old bastard's here right now.
Good.
That's brilliant.
But I actually kind of wanted to ask you all about Dickie Greenleaf, because I don't want to totally minimize this character and make him seem like he's just a one-dimensional cad, because I think there's more to him too.
Yeah, I mean, he's seductive in his own way, and certainly the world in which he lives is very seductive, and I think the film smartly makes him far more appealing when we first meet him than as it goes along, you know, and certainly in the final moments when we learn some bits of his past we didn't know before. Mm-hmm. First, he seems like a guy who has everything Ripley could ever possibly want. And then you kind of start to wonder, why get hung up on someone this creepy who doesn't really care for him and who's isn't particularly, you know, well, talented or not particularly doesn't really have much to call his own except his name and the money that comes with it.
Yeah, it's that seductive quality mixed with capriciousness, I think, that makes him kind of a dangerous character once he gets around someone. Well, obviously, once he gets around someone like Tom. But, I mean, he's a destructive presence in the way that he moves through life and he moves through people that are drawn to him. Like, Marge tells us that like, people are attracted to him just naturally. And we see that go badly with the woman whom he impregnates mm-hmm. and who commits suicide, you know. But it's just, like, kind of there in how quickly he gets tired of things and of people and moves on to the next thing. He wants to move on to the next city in Italy. He wants to move on to the next woman. He wants to move on to the next male acquaintance, you know. And, like, I think you, again, when Freddie enters the picture is when you really start to feel the danger of that quality, because you see him shift the light, as Marge yeah. calls it, from Tom to Freddie, and that's when, you know, Tom's shadows, you know, come into play. It's not Dickie's fault, but it's dangerous when it comes into proximity of someone like Tom.
Yeah, that scene is so beautiful, the one you mentioned when they're out on the yacht and Tom's up there alone and Marge kind of comes over to him and is sympathetic to his situation, which is that Dickie gives people attention, and when he gives that attention, you just feel so great. Then he moves on to something else and it puts you in a very cold and lonely place. But at the same time, one of the things that plays in Marge's head is that she knows a side of Dickie that nobody knows, not even Tom or not any of his friends. I mean, that there is, you know, a sensitivity to him in a love that comes through when the two of them are together alone, that is key to making Tom's story about what happened not persuasive to her.
Do you believe Marge, or do you think that she is just also under Dickie's spell? Like, because we don't really see any of those moments between them. We're told of them. And obviously, you know, with Tom as our point of view character, we are inclined to not fully believe them.
I believe her. I believe that the intention to marry was something mm-hmm. real that happened, as she says it was. So I take that at face value.
I think it's probably also, we sort of get a glimpse of them behind closed doors, but we never really see them apart from Tom, do we?
No.
I can think of. So, I mean, you know, really don't know what the relationship is like when he's not around.
But we certainly get the sense that she knows him really well and knows all of his flaws and stays with him anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And so for all those things to be true, I think there has to be another level to that relationship that maybe we don't see, or we have to take her word for.
Yeah, there's also kind of the, you know, maybe it's the way things are done in their social circle that you don't give up on something that, you know, a possible engagement, you don't give up on that quickly.
Yeah, Tom's interpretation of their engagement, like, again, he is our point of view character, and, you know, I think you're sort of inclined to take his opinion of things, even when he is clearly, an unreliable protagonist, if ever there was one.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, his interpretation of their engagement as a marriage of convenience, mm-hmm. or however you want to frame it within this upper echelon of American society, you know, is just something that has to be done, that is kind of independent of any feelings that they may share.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that feels more real to me. But again, maybe that is just because I'm seeing it through Tom's view. And I guess it also depends on whether we believe that Dickie does have homosexual impulses.
My feeling is no. Feeling is that Tom completely misreads the situation. I think when he talks about, come on, you know, what about when you're taking mm-hmm. a bath? I mean, what about that moment? You had to feel something, and this whole charade about having sex with Marge while he was on the boat is some sort of a thing that they all had to be around. I think Tom gets it wrong. Yeah. That's my interpretation anyway.
I don't think he's above sensing those impulses in others and exploiting them.
Yes.
And using them as a form of magnetism, though.
Yes, that is exactly what I
yeah, I think he was shocked in the bathtub scene. I think he was shocked only by the overtness of the overture, not the fact that those feelings were there at all.
Right, but he would have, I think that would have been a spot where he would have accepted those overtures if
I don't think he would ever, I think he's willing to push it that far, but no further, and even that was a little too far.
And I think there's also an element where Tom is so, as good as he is, doesn't quite get the role 100% right. I mean, and that's something that Freddie exposes on multiple occasions. But like, he thinks that he has a read on Dickie, but he doesn't quite have that right. And he thinks he knows how, you know, a rich person is supposed to act and decorate his home and be Dickie Greenleaf. But that is a little bit off too. There's something where he's an imposter in those situations as well. And it's something that there's a degree to which he's socially inept. In my view.
The only thing here that looks like Dickie is you.
Yeah, and I mean, I think his impersonation of Dickie become, like, he can't help it becoming him once Dickie is gone. And once he is, like, his true self creeps into the impersonation of Dickie he is doing. Like, we see that in the classical motifs that are coming into his decor, you know, and, you know, the fact that he looks like Dickie, but, like, he is still Tom, you know, like, he can't fully subsume Dickie. See, I kind of am questioning, Scott, your characterization of Tom as just this master manipulator con man, because to me, he always seems to be figuring it out as he goes along. Like, he doesn't have that being able to see the next steps quality that I associate with con man, because he's always taken off guard. He can improvise really well, and he can pivot when someone, you know, is starting to catch on to his bullshit. But it doesn't seem to me that he is ever thinking about the ways in which this can go wrong and accounting for that.
Yeah, maybe not. I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, he does prepare. I mean, he certainly prepares to be a part of Dickie's life, and that plotting pays off as far as, like, you know, the
I'm talking about once he kills Dickie.
Yeah.
And like, his incredible decision to try and become Dickie instead of running away from this horrible crime that he has committed, you know, and hiding out. The con becomes a lot more complex then, and obviously a lot more fraught then. And he doesn't seem to me to have thought that out the same way that he has thought out how he is going to become Dickie's friend, or, you know, kind of become part of his world. I think, like, once it becomes actually taking over Dickie's life as opposed to just being a barnacle,
yeah,
he's not as.
But I don't think I don't think he anticipates it going where it goes.
Of course, not.
So,
yeah.
So he has to. At that point, he has to start. Yeah. The moment he hits Dickie with an oar, all plans go out the window, and it becomes a time when he has to improvise constantly.
I think the subtext here is Genevieve thinks she could do it better.
I mean, I was thinking about, that's why it made me so uncomfortable, because it was just like seeing
all the things
he did wrong.
You could totally get away with it. So what do you all share my grand unifying theory of Matt Damon as a movie star? I mean, how does someone not fit to be Cary Grant's bellboy become a movie star of such endurance?
I think this movie is an interesting way to kind of meditate on that, because it is, you know, among other things, I think it's a movie about acting and what it takes to assume a role. And Damon's had, like, several different phases of his. He's very malleable. My first impression of him was as the sort of wasting away and Courage Under Fire. And, you know, more recently in the Bourne movies, to borrow a line from a Sharpling and Worcester routine, he kind of looks like a high school wrestling coach. I mean, just his physical transformation over. And now he's like, his current run of films, he's kind of like, you know, sort of doughy and overweight. And it is remarkable that just to watch the physical transformations there. But he is a pretty flexible guy. I don't think there is a, unlike Cary Grant, I don't think there is a Matt Damon persona.
Yeah, maybe that's it.
I think he's lacking a certain magnetism or charismatic personality that we associate with the movie star. But I think his malleable qualities take the place of that. Like, it take the place of that when he is paired with the right material. Like, for me, the complicating factor in your theory is The Martian, where he is just like, I mean, he is that movie for the most part. It is mostly just him, and he is kind of holding the screen for so much of that movie. But that is also a movie where there is just so much happening, and like, there's so much dialogue and, you know, very quippy, fun dialogue that he can deliver well, because he does have this sort of like comedic, you know, form he can take. So in terms of like thinking of a movie star as someone who like holds the screen, I think The Martian complicates your theory. But I think in terms of showing that he is an actor who benefits from the right material, it does.
How about this modification? He's somebody who has to sweat for the role, you know, I mean, that's something he has to work hard at something that, for, say, Jude Law in this film comes absolutely easy. Yeah. I mean, the beauty of Jude Law's performance in this movie is just the utter self-confidence. There's not a moment where he gets annoyed, maybe, and angry, but the way he carries himself, I mean, he carries himself like a rich guy who doesn't
have to
worry about anything.
You feel like he's being Jude Law. You know,
and that he's comfortable in his own skin. Yeah. And with Matt Damon, you have a malleability, as Keith said, and maybe he just has to hustle a little bit more. So we can make some modifications there. But it is he's an intriguing actor. And I do really like this performance, especially from him. I think it's just the perfect Matt Damon role.
He plays into that too, I think, and the movie lets him, where he's just so good when he's practicing, when he's kind of not quite getting the role right ahead of time, when you realize you see the effort he has to put into it, and like, you know, just physically, like when his hair's not all together there, he looks very kind of young and unsure of himself. There's even something about his teeth in this movie that feels a little
they seem really big.
They do seem really big, don't they? I don't know if that was accentuated in some way or not, but a little off.
Like, even when he is shirtless, like the first scene on the beach when they, you know, his pasty undercoat or whatever, you
undercoat,
know,
that's right.
Like, I mean, he's very fit in this movie. You know, he's as fit as Jude Law, but it just looks wrong. You
it
know,
does. It's primer.
Yeah. And like, yeah, the paleness is part of that, but also it's just kind of how he carries himself in that moment.
Yeah, and those swim trunks and everything. He's just, he looks so
he's not preening or, you know.
No, I mean, and there's no way that Dickie Greenleaf or Jude Law as Dickie Greenleaf would do just fine in yellow swim trunks like that, but not Matt Damon.
You're so white. Did you ever see a guy so white, Marge? Gray, actually.
It's just an undercoat.
Say again?
You know, a primer.
That's fun. Margie likes that because she's so white.
Yes, I do, and you're not funny.
So the character of Peter Smith Kingsley is entirely Minghella's invention. Do you think the film is well served by that character?
Yeah, I think it's a deeper film than it would be without him. I feel like to give Ripley someone that you could actually maybe have a shot at happiness with, to feel like sort of the absence, like whatever he's missing that makes him somewhat less than human, and to take that away is a really good choice, and makes this a deeper movie than it would be otherwise.
Yeah, you need him there to show like the scenario in which this could go well for Tom, you know, and like how the happy ending that he could have, even though, you know, this is going back to what I was saying about it feels like he's not thinking ahead. Like the whole time when he's with Peter, I'm just thinking to myself, Meredith is still out there, dude. Like Meredith still thinks you're Dickie Greenleaf. Like this is like
this is pre-internet though. They could not run into each other.
If he has been in these circles for this long and doesn't realize that everyone is eventually going to run into everyone on some ski trip or at the opera, like, you know, that's a huge error on his part, especially because Meredith and Peter, like, he's seen that they have a relationship.
But keep in mind, he's prepared to kill Meredith, and he can't do it because she's with people. Mm-hmm. That's an inquiry that he makes of her on the boat. Like, he finds out that she's there with other people. I think if she's by herself,
other people who see him,
right? Exactly. So yeah. I think,
but even before they're on that boat, I'm screaming that in my head at him. You know, like when they're starting to feel each other out in Rome, it's like, dude, take care of Meredith first. Not in that way.
Yeah, I agree that Peter Smith Kingsley is a really good invention, and I think one of the things I like about that character in particular is that he's sort of a sounding board for Tom to really say how he's feeling. I think maybe you could slight the film for suddenly making subtext text and having Tom really start to articulate all the stuff about being a dark room and trying to lock the past away. And you could say maybe Minghella is telling us things that we should figure out on our own, but it's just so affecting to me, those scenes of Tom being able to share as much of himself as possible with Peter. You know, it just makes it that, as you say, a much richer film for that. So, again, it's such a model for how you engage with a piece of someone else's work and adapting a piece of work and just trying to think your way through it and have a take on it and not just translate it, but do have a point of view that's a little different and a little audacious.
And you don't throw out the Scouring of the Shire and throw in like four different endings to Lord of the Rings. Do the ending that Tolkien... Oh, I'm getting off subject. Anyway.
Well, and we wouldn't have the ending that we do have without that character. And the ending is, you know, for whatever you want to say about making subtext text, like, it is really, really affecting. And like, that's partly the character, but it's also just partly the filmmaking, which I really, really like.
Yeah, me too. Though I don't know. Did you see this movie with an audience in 1999, Keith?
I'm sure critics count, so no, I don't. I think okay. I just saw it.
Yeah, I because people had a really negative reaction to that.
Oh no, I was in Madison then. No, I don't remember the audience reacting.
Yeah, it was like one of those things where it was like, and I couldn't really figure out why.
Is it just like a happy ending denied? Like, that's a very like simplistic reaction to have to this movie.
Yeah.
Sorry if anyone listening had that reaction. Please write in and explain to me.
Oh, that would be good, actually. That would be good if you were like one of the people who was like, when Talented Mr. Ripley ended, why he reacted that way. Because it reminded me of the reaction to one of the films we covered earlier this year, It Comes at Night, by the end, the small audience I was with had turned on the film in a major way and was very upset by the ending. But I think the ending is really nice in the way, and I like how he bookends it by giving you that little piece of it at the beginning and then leaving you where you do at the end, and you get that nice shot of the closet door closing and on the mirror images and stuff. And that's really good filmmaking.
And the choice not to like show us the act, to just let us hear it, like as we're staring at Tom's face, like that's a really bold choice, I think, like forcing us to look at this face as we're hearing that horrible act take place.
He's really kind of asking Peter to give a eulogy for himself in a way, because he's dying as well at that moment, and he wants to hear the best case for him before he smothers what's left of his soul.
It won't happen, but now I kind of want to see a Ripley sequel with Matt Damon in the role, like one of the later novels or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm fascinated. I've never read the Highsmith novel, but I'm fascinated by the idea that like this is a character who can have continuing adventures. Because like I feel like this is the end for him, you know, like I don't see how he continues on once he gets off that boat, but clearly he does.
Well, they're not jolly adventures.
yeah, I would guess that. But again, this just goes back to me thinking that Ripley is not like a particularly smooth criminal and feeling that he's, you know, he's going to get what's coming to him. But
well, I think Highsmith probably sees him as a pretty smooth criminal. She was apparently with Purple Noon. She mostly approved of the film, but did not like that it ends with him being apprehended or some suggestion he's being apprehended. She thought that was pure nonsense. it was like inserting this morality into the story where it didn't belong. So it was certainly in her mind that he would continue.
Luckily for Tom, he can always depend on our culture's ongoing belief in female hysteria. Which is really what saves him in the end.
All right. Well, with that, we'll be right back to get into some feedback on recent episodes.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Now it's time for feedback. We got a couple of nice emails about our pairing of Ed Wood and the Disaster Artist. Keith, do you want to get us started?
Sure. This is excerpted from a long missive from a listener named Josh about So Bad It's Good Cinema. Josh writes, I'm writing in response to the comment that the best bad movies have a certain kind of magic. One of you pointed out that there's often a personal touch to the best bad movies, and that's something I wanted to back up and try to figure out, because it's something I've puzzled over for a while now. As someone who loves a lot of trash genre cinema from the 60s and 70s, I've long resisted the idea that movies are so bad, they're good. Some of that just boils down to the fact that I quit believing in guilty pleasures along the way. I like what I like, and sometimes I like it for its insanity or because of some indefinable thing. But over the years, there have been a few so bad it's good movies trotted out as the next big thing, and most of them are just unwatchable. My big example of this is Troll 2, which is entertaining in little YouTube clips, but watching the whole thing is an exercise in tedium, largely because there's nothing interesting going on at all. When you watch Plan 9, there's something oddly heartfelt about the way Wood is paying tribute to Lugosi, even in the insane way he does it, or the way the story is ultimately a plea for peace, one that basically used the same plot as The Day the Earth Stood Still. None of that is to say that Wood was a good filmmaker, but there's an earnestness and openness to his film that something like Troll 2 never had for me. I don't know that I could ever explain that feeling to someone who doesn't watch a lot of movies, but it's the same feeling you get when you see a Tarantino or Scorsese movie, that here is someone who loves cinema and is excited about what they're doing. And it's the same thing that makes The Room work for me. There's no denying that Tommy Wiseau got hurt by a woman and wants to take it out on film. And there's also a sense that he wants to comment on all the problems of the world. Look at the bizarre drug dealer sequence. But when Wiseau says, if a lot of people loved each other, the world would be a better place. I should do that in an accent, right? I always feel like the applause that greets it is only half ironic. It's a dopey sentiment and out of place, but it's also heartfelt and earnest, putting himself out there in a risky way. And that's what makes the movie special for me. Yes, it's bad and horribly written and gleefully inept, but it's also so evidently a labor of love that I kind of adore it as the personal film that it is. If a lot of people loved each other. Okay. all right, I can't do it. So what does everyone, there's a lot to actually unpack here. What does everybody else think?
I mean, that was the a point that I made. I mean, he said someone,
but not as eloquently.
Not as elegantly, and not at this length. But I did feel like The Room, and you know, a film like Glenn or Glenda, and I think he makes a good case here for Plan 9 as well. There is something personal and distinctive about it that goes beyond just sheer incompetence, and that makes it special. I mean, you look at a film like Manos, the Hands of Fate, for example. Which is an MST3K classic. But I watched Manos, the Hands of Fate without commentary for a piece I wrote, and it's tough going because it doesn't have that personal touch that these other films have.
A better example than Troll 2, I think. No offense to Josh, because I think he makes very good points here, but I find Troll 2 pretty entertaining on its own terms, because there is something insane happening in any moment. If we differ on the specific example, I think the sentiment here is really strong, and I think we kind of hold our nose, as we use the phrase, so bad it's good, in the last episode. At least I did, even if you couldn't hear it on the air, because
nose holding is really doesn't come through that well.
Yeah.
What audio do you phone. Mean?
but I've kind of given up on guilty pleasures as well. I just like, you know, if it moves me in some way, you know, I'm for it.
Even if you get shamed relentlessly by me?
what do you shame me for? What do you,
I don't know.
But I think the trick is to think of bad as an aesthetic quality rather than a quality. Mm-hmm. You know, like a movie can be bad in its execution, in its conception, and in its performances, but that doesn't make it bad as a film. Does that make sense?
Sure.
As an experience to be witnessed.
Yeah, the badness is its aesthetic.
Yeah, I don't think you have a phenomenon like The Room happen if there isn't something special about it. I there are plenty of incompetently made films out there. This has gotten the following that it has. Has to do with a lot of different things. You know, it being personal most of all, and I think that's what keeps me coming back to it and keeps midnight movie audiences coming back to it as well.
I think there's also, we didn't really get into this, but I think there's sort of, it's truly bad movies or truly unusually bad movies like this are harder to find now, because to mm-hmm. most things that get out in the world in some way, there's kind of a baseline competence to them. I mean, there's enough like film school grads working on the technical crew or in the editing bay or whatever. And anything that comes out through, say it turns up on Netflix, it's probably been through like some sort of purchase by some distributor who saw some profitability in it. And the way for a truly bad movie like The Room to slip through the machinery and make it to the public eye is, I don't think there's as many ways for it to get there as it was in Ed Wood's day.
No, maybe not. But we have some more thoughts on this issue. During our discussion of Ed Wood and the Disaster Artist, we talked about the uncomfortable feeling of watching movies about failed filmmakers. Listener Gregory from Washington, D.C. has some questions about it. Genevieve?
Gregory writes, I was interested in your discussion about whether making a biopic about bad movie directors is disrespectful. I recently saw an appearance by both James Franco and Tommy Wiseau on Jimmy Kimmel Live, which made me realize that the subject of The Disaster Artist was actually able to approve the movie and is apparently involved in its promotion. Ed Wood was dead for over 15 years when Burton's film about him came out. I think the relative recency of the Disaster Artist subject matter and the fact that the principal character is alive and involved is a major difference between it and Ed Wood. Do you think this affected the production and that Franco had to pull punches, so to speak? And do movies of this kind benefit from greater temporal separation between creator and subject?
I don't think Wiseau is there, like, sort of approving every line or anything. We ran an interview at UpRocks, Mike Ryan did an interview with the writers, and it sounds like Wiseau was sort of a force to be contained in some ways. There was the original draft had him doing a scene with Dave Franco, and he insisted he do a scene with James Franco. And you know, it's sort of that sort of nonsensical thing was sort of the thing that resulted from it was kind of pushed to the end of the movie, as you saw in the film. It doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. It's just sort of like a little, except as it's sort of like a little nudging gag. But the other thing I complained about was the script supervisor, played by Seth Rogen, had too much screen time.
Yeah, about a lot of obviously there's a pretty it's a lot easier for filmmakers to make biopics about people who are not around to complain about it. So
but Wiseau has also been involved in the promotion of this film, which I think is what is maybe complicating that a bit, but maybe not, because Wiseau is also just a publicity I mean, he just likes to have attention paid to him. That is very clear from his public behavior. So
he doesn't understand why he's getting the attention or where it's coming from.
Yeah, like it's hard for me to envision a version of the Disaster Artist that Wiseau would not be willing to go out and talk about just for the sake of being able to go on TV and have attention paid to
him. This is entirely to his benefit. I mean, he's been steering into this curve from the beginning, and he's been making money doing it. He appears for the on behalf of the room all the time and absorbs every crazy question and audience behavior, you know, at screening after screening. I don't know. I mean, but at the same time, I guess, you know, the film does push a little bit. Not
does a little bit, maybe not as much as the book, which I'm currently absorbing via audiobook at Genevieve's recommendation, as Greg Sestero. The other interesting thing in that interview, which you should read at uprocks.com, because I'm a little self-promotion here, is that...
Wiseau-esque.
Is that the writers have seen the film with Wiseau twice. And in the second time, he got up to leave to go to the bathroom or whatever during the scene in which James Franco's Tommy abuses the actress playing Lisa on the set. I don't think he wanted to sit through that twice. So maybe some of it's kind of getting through the many layers of self-mythology or whatever that keeps Tommy Wiseau insulated from the rest of the world the rest of us live in. But I don't know.
I saw a tweet from Tommy Wiseau, who got on Twitter it's all promotion, obviously, okay. But I believe that's where I saw him tweeting that he 99.9% approved of this, the Disaster Artist. So go ahead and think to yourself what the 0.1% he didn't approve of.
The 0.1% is this whole really long scene. Really abusive. He's not very good at math.
The percentage wise takes up probably 8% of the movie.
Exactly. Well, as always, we appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. We may feature your response on a future episode or post it on Facebook for discussion. That wraps up this episode of The Next Picture Show. In part two, we'll bring in Call Me By Your Name and talk over how both these films address pleasure and heartbreak under the Italian sun. Look for that later this week, or better yet, subscribe to The Next Picture Show on Apple Podcasts or your podcatcher of choice. Find us at nextpictureshow.net, follow us at facebook.com/nextpictureshow, and follow us on Twitter at @nextpicturepod so you'll always know when a new episode drops. Until then, no peeping, Tommy. Tommy, no peeping. We'll see you next time.
Tu vuoi l'americano, americano, americano, vaccinato.